And the beauty of Loftivism is that puts the big guy who has such a tremendous obsession with him or herself between the rock and the hard place. Because if your opponent reacts, he will look stupid. He will end up arresting Barrel or banning the toy protest. If he doesn't react, he will look weak. And people will understand that they can get away with it. And they will replicate this over and over until they undermine their authority. So understanding how the political satire and Loftivism work is a very, very promising field for a nonviolent movement.
That's Serge Popovich talking about how to topple dictators with nonviolent strategies. And this is the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. This is where we use the lenses of risk and uncertainty to explore all types of fascinating topics. This one is about risk in opposing oppression and making political and social change happen. And regardless of your political affiliation, whether you are a liberal or conservative, I'd hope that you agree with me that dictators, whether they be on the far right or the far left, or whether they be religious in addition to being ideological, are not a positive force in this world. And I similarly hope that you agree with me that the suppression of various economic and civil rights is a negative force in this world. And yet, in many places, strongman leadership is on the rise around the world, and democracy appears to be in retreat. And perhaps what's also very prominent in the West are entrenched political interests. And let's talk about probabilities in the face of dictatorships and those entrenched political interests for a moment. Dictators have access to money, force, the media, and other mechanisms to maintain a stranglehold on power. Special interests have similar, perhaps not as extensive, mechanisms. But how can dictators and those types of entrenched interests be toppled? Well, I want you to meet Serge Popovich, my guest in this episode. Serge is a political activist from Serbia. In the late 1990s, he was a student leader in the Otpor, or resistance movement, which helped topple then-president Slobodan Milosevic in the year 2000. And the role of Otpor and its strategies of non-violent resistance played a critical role in the end of the Milosevic regime. But if you were to try and predict what might cause that in the mid-1990s, and Milosevic had de facto power well before he formally became the president in 1997, you wouldn't really have bet on the political opposition at the time because it was very divided and ineffective. Perhaps you might have thought that when the 1999 NATO bombings happened, that might have brought about regime change. But no, it was a grassroots movement that started small and employed nonviolent strategies. And Serge himself, like other political opponents at that time, was arrested and beaten. But in the end, he and his compatriots created an unstoppable force. And there are many lessons in all of that, particularly, and this show being a show about risk and uncertainty, about how change can happen in the face of long odds. There are lessons in what Otpor did that can apply to those opposing dictatorships around the world. There are also lessons to any movement trying to make change happen in other areas, whether or not we're talking about, I don't know, your local rubbish collection, or US gun laws, or some form of corruption happening near you, or whatever else. And that's what Serge does now. He co-runs the Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies, or CANVAS, which advocates nonviolent resistance to promote human rights and democracy. And he has worked with pro-democracy movements through CANVAS all around the world in over 50 countries. Serge speaks all over the world. He runs workshops like the one at Harvard, which is where he was when we spoke for this episode. And he's also written a book called Blueprint for Revolution, How to Use Rice Pudding, Lego Men, and Other nonviolent techniques to galvanize communities, overthrow dictators, and simply change the world. And we talk about all of those things. We get into Serge's three success principles for nonviolent resistance. We talk about democracy in our current environment, also in the context of millennials. We talk about spreading out risk in opposition movements, nonviolent tactics and strategies, the difference between laftivism and political satire. We talk about clicktivism or slacktivism, fake news, and a whole lot more. I think you'll find this very interesting and enlightening. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Serge Popovich. Serge, welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on. I've been looking forward to this.
Pleasure being on All Things Risk, Ben, and ready to see your questions.
Okay, so your book is wonderful, but you wrote it Blueprint for Revolution in 2015, and a lot's happened since then. So I hope that you're busy nowadays, but you can tell me how have the last few months been for you?
Well, I mean, the Blueprint for Revolution, when it came out as a story about the movements across the world that my organization, Canvas, has been working on, and also about the story of the Serbian movement called Otpor, which was kind of the prerequisite for this work. And nonviolent struggle and nonviolent movements is ever-growing and everlasting field. And it probably changes faster now with the new technology that it has in the past. But since the Gandhi and Martin Luther King, we are looking at the evolution of nonviolent struggle. Whether we are looking at how groups learn and how the groups learn how to grow and how the groups learn how to deal with risks and the oppression, whether we are looking at how oppressive governments find a way to suppress movements even before they arise, or we are looking at the effect of the new technology on organization mobilization, political and social movements are ever-growing subject, and every week you learn something new, something creative, or something awful, depending on the side that you are looking at. So it changed dramatically, and I mean, it didn't change in all the ways I would wish it to change. Nonviolent field is there. There is more than ever need to learn and read books like Blueprint for Revolution, because I think the human rights and democracy are on the decay, and we need kind of defend it. What's new is that seems that the demand for this book is coming from this knowledge is coming from the countries that we were considering solid democracies in the past. So it seems that there is a mushroom of the political movement that needs to tackle these issues on how to defend democracy where people had it and took it for granted for a long time, places like Philippines or Poland. And then on the other side, with the new technology, the challenges come. How to distinguish between the real activism and the clicktivism, how to deal with ever-growing wish of the authoritarian states to control, censor, and monitor internet, who is on the front line of these kind of stuff and things like that.
What I just wanted to get into before we start talking about nonviolent resistance is your background, and if you can give us a bit of a summary of Otpor and how you got into this, because I presume you, well, what I've read about you, you didn't, when you were growing up, you didn't think that you would become this activist, but somehow you got into it. So wondering if you could, for my listeners, give a little bit of background into what was happening in Serbia in the late 1990s.
Okay, the story begins in the 90s when I was kind of young student, more involved into dating girls and playing bass guitar in a rock band, when the really bad guy came to power. Some of your listeners may remember the name of Slobodan Milošević, also known as the Butcher of Balkans. Mm-hmm. So during the 90s, the people in Serbia have seen their freedom shrink, their economy falling apart, being involved in five wars. And basically, out of my generation, there were only two choices. You could flee and live somewhere a decent life. And unfortunately, we had a huge brain drain. Most of the young people have left the country in the 90s because they see no perspective. Or you could stand back and fight. So part of my generation was involved in student movement, which started in 1992, continued through the 1996-97. And then around 1998, when the things went really south, we were involved in four wars and lost them. We hit the largest world hyperinflation at the time, and we were preparing for another war, which ended with ethnical cleansing in Kosovo and then NATO bombing. As a country, we decided that there will be nobody else to do this job for us, that the international community miserably failed, Serbian opposition miserably failed, and it's time to build something which is unique, which was called Otpor. Hmm. Otpor was a movement growing fast from 11 people to 70,000 people, which at the end of the day was instrumental in ending up with Milosevic at October the 5th. Primarily, the group strategy was to focus on the young people, because bringing young people to the polls was what really made change, and then preparing for the election fraud which we experienced before, mm-hmm. and getting ready to capitalize on numbers. So basically, looking at this strategy, Otpor was terribly successful, and this is what really bring me to this work.
Mm-hmm. And you used a lot of humor, and how did you grow from, you know, 11 people to 70,000? What were some of the things? I mean, some of the stories you tell are quite interesting, but the use of humor to me is very interesting.
Basically, the Otpor was a very witty and positive movement, which was really important in a very murky and sad situation which country was. And I think the part of Otpor's appeal was the fact that it was witty and full of humor. We were, aside of having the really clear vision and really clear planning and strategy, the very approach of the movement was to do a low-risk actions and things like street theaters and pranks and leaflets and symbols and slogans, and basically the things that you can do under the very limited political environment. And part of this was understanding that humor is a very powerful tool, and there are reasons why humor is such a powerful tool, and it applies to movements worldwide. First of all, movement breaks fear, and nothing like a good joke can save you from being afraid of going to the surgery or to the dentist. Second, movement makes your humor makes your movement in, because people like to be around the people who are funny. So when we were coming out with public actions, like, you know, coming out with a telescope at the day of the lunar eclipse, 4.5 meters long, where people in a main shopping district can take a look and see, like, Milosevic star is falling. And, you know, you can look for yourself that there are signs in the sky showing that Milosevic sign is falling down. And of course, it dragged a lot of media attention, it dragged a lot of common people. When we came out with the petrol bottle with Milosevic's face brought into the main shopping zone, where people can really put a little coin inside the barrel and then earn a right to hit the face of behated guy with a bat, and then this big bang really brings more people and more people. And these were really things which were making movement attractive. Funnily enough, it also dragged the attention of the police. Part of the reason why movement was so attractive was that it was always putting regime between the rock and the hard place. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you're a police and you're coming to the event where a bunch of downtown shoppers are having fun with the president's face on a barrel, what will you do? Obviously, search for organizers. Organizers are nowhere to be seen. Arrest downtown shoppers, that's not a really good idea. But because you need to stop this, because if people see that they can do this and get away with this, you will need to do something. And this is why the police arrested the barrel at the end of the day. So having a police constantly as the part of our pranks, and having the state apparatus constantly being dragged to show more oppression in the face of more witty humor was really something that influenced the fast Otpor grow and its positive image.
Yeah, the symbol of the police taking a barrel away. You know, nothing could be more absurd, could it? You know,
we were also very skillful with media. I think one of the reasons why movement was very successful that we really paid attention to this alternative media scenery. In every country, however oppressed it can be, you have the state-controlled media, which are normally controlled by your opponent, but there are radio stations, there are newspapers, recently there are new media. So everything you do, aside of touch of humor, can be planned tactic. And successful movements plan their tactic by imagining the picture, what is going to appear tomorrow in the newspaper, and building around it. And it also has to do with a lot with the name of your show. The movements become appealing and the numbers become great if you lower the risk bar. There is a lot to be said about the level of the risk in nonviolent movements and the level of participation. Not too many people would risk going on a street demonstration in a place like Iran and getting killed. Mm-hmm. A lot of people will risk having a ringtone on their phone, right, or wearing a little badge or participating in a street theater, because the more people will participate, not only if you are doing something cool, but also if people know that they can get away with it. Mm-hmm. Not too many people will take high risks, but if you as a movement strategically bring down the risk bar and offer people something non-risky to participate in, then the numbers will exponentially grow.
Right. So if they can do little things like you talked in some of your previous conversations about leaving, you know, little stickers on, you know, all over the city or on public transport or whatever. That's something that an ordinary person who doesn't like the situation can easily do, as opposed to asking a bunch of people to, you know, sacrifice, you know, half their lives to get involved in opposition, you know, politics.
I agree with you. I think the offering people low-risk tactics, like successful movement all together across the world, whether big or small, whether in authoritarian regimes or in democracy, are sharing three universal principles of success. Mm-hmm. And these three universal principles of success is whether or not you can build unity with different groups. Mm-hmm. Because larger the groups, but also more diverse the constituencies that you mobilize, the better the chances to success. Second is what we are talking about now. Now it's planning. Successful movements plan their strategy. Otpor plan their strategy to mobilize young people. Otpor plan their strategy to go into how to prevent election fraud. Otpor plan their strategy what to do if the elections are stolen. So also you also plan your tactic. And you need to offer people the tactics that are attractive, witty, and low risk enough to draw the people in. As you said, not too many people will risk to get fired, but many people will make a noise by hitting a pots and pans from the windows, which was one very successful tactic in Serbia, but also all across the Eastern Europe and Latin America, making symbolic gestures, making noises, putting stickers, putting symbols. This is where the common people can come in. And the more movement is capable of offering larger participation, not only to those who are ready to outrun police on the street, but also to those who are either too busy or too old or too young to really participate in a street protest, you see that there is a planning in the movement and you can say, wow, this movement can become successful.
Okay, let's maybe back up a step, Serja, and talk a bit about the importance of nonviolent resistance, because this is something that strikes me as incredibly powerful, and perhaps it's something that many don't realize, that in order to make, you know, make some type of change happen in an oppressive environment, particularly in, you know, in a place where there's a dictator, that that nonviolence actually works.
Nonviolent discipline, together with unity and planning, is the third most important principle in this holy trinity. Why? Not only that nonviolence is more ethical than the violence; it's also far more likely to succeed. Mm-hmm. The study done by two American scientists shows that actually the nonviolent movements are twice more likely to succeed or meet their goals than the violent movement. Then the second part is coming from common sense. If you are challenging the state apparatus, what is the battlefield you would like to challenge it? Is this the place where the state has a police and military and judiciary and you have nothing? So, you know, sticking to violent struggle seems to somebody listening to you from a Great Britain, like, you know, you want to pick a game and play with I don't know, Mike Tyson. Would you pick a boxing ring to challenge the Mike Tyson?
Right.
That means picking arms to challenge Assad. Mm-hmm. So actually, the boxing ring is the last place that you want to challenge the Mike Tyson. You may want to try Scrabble. You may want to try a game of chess. And these are the nonviolent choices in this particular case. So, A, it's more moral and ethical than the violence. B, it has larger chances to succeed. And C, it makes more sense because you don't want to box with Mike Tyson. Speaking of planning, what we figured out is that nonviolent discipline is a skill. Skills can be taught and learned. This is not only tied to the movements which operate on a high religious ground run by people like Gandhi or Martin Luther King. It is very useful if you have a moral background coming to your movement from, for example, religion. It makes things much easier. But even in a non-religiously backed movements like Serbian Otpor, even in a very, very violent environments like the Serbian or Egyptian or, you know, you name it, you have it, it has nothing to do with mentality. It has to do with a clear decision of the leading group to impose nonviolence on its troops. And nonviolence can be imposed. You can preach it, you can put it in your strategic document, you can teach people from day one as they are recruited that this is nonviolent movement, and it is nonviolent for strategic purposes, not only ethical. And then, of course, you can train your people to avoid violence, because, you know, you have 100,000 people peacefully demonstrating on the street, and then you have one black bloc idiot starting burning cars. And guess what? Who gets the tomorrow's cover page of Guardian?
Right.
That guy. And I mean, you can train your people to stay nonviolent on the site. Once again, back to planning. You can plan the tactics that are less likely to end up in violence. If you push tens of thousands of your supporters against the police, this is where the violence can occur. If you make tens of thousands of your supporters singing and hitting pots and pans from their windows, this is where violence has no chance to occur. So it's your conscious choice. It's your strategic choice. It's the part of your training, and it's also your tactical choice. So you can decide and you can turn your movement into a nonviolent disciplined machine, regardless of religious background or the history of the country. And there are a million proofs in contemporary movement how it was possible.
To get into the concept of unity for a moment, and I've heard you talk about this, and in your, you know, your book, the concept of, you know, sort of thinking big and starting small, which is something that I in so many domains it works. But the your point about vision, I'm wondering if you could emphasize that a little bit more. What is it better to simply oppose someone, or is it fundamental to have, you know, a clear vision of what we want to change to look like? And if so, then how do you get people to, you know, unify themselves around that vision?
I think the vision is in the core of every movement. And just to demystify this big word, vision is a simple answer to the question, if I would be a Harry Potter or Hermione Granger for a day, what would be different? And it is also the answer to the question, where are we going? Why we are doing this? So this is not just protesting the bad government. This is not just protesting the stupid decisions. This is just not protesting corruption. This is where I want to be. I want society where corrupted people will be accounted for. I want society where more people are involved in decision-making process. And now you need this answer loud and clear. And the way you present this answer, it also relates to how many people you can mobilize. Anger can be a very powerful mobilizer, and especially anger around corrupt and stupid politicians, which we have no lack of, whether we are talking Serbia or Great Britain or United States. But anger is, without a hope or answer to the question, where are we going, is a destructive force per se. So not only that you need to have the answer to the question, where are we going, you also need to listen to the constituencies or the groups you try to mobilize, because the people will join groups if there is something for them in this movement. Not too many people will just join movements because they're philanthropic positive personalities. Unfortunately, we do not account for the majority on this world. You need to find a way to communicate your movement to the people who will join for their own little selfish interests. And this is the majority of people. Movements become massive when topics in the movement become personal for the people. Look at the election fraud. While we are voting, it is, you know, you are voting conservatives, I am voting Labour, somebody else is voting Lib Dems, whatever. Imagine the British Electoral Committee starts meddling with your vote. It will equally outrage people regardless of their political affiliation, because that means somebody is putting the hand in their own pocket. And somebody is so this is where numbers become large, and this is where issues become personal. So you want to take a look at what personal issues you are driving people, and you want to involve into your vision the solution to the problems that tackle groups personally, because this is how you recruit groups.
Sure, sure. That makes a lot of sense. And you know, I think when you see, well, maybe you could talk a little bit about where movements fall apart.
But once again, we learn a lot from successes. We learn a lot from mistakes. And observing movements, and basically after the Serbian nonviolent movement, my organization, Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies, went to work with 50 different groups from all across the world. And, you know, we try to see what worked, what is universal. We also try to see what little things are different, which needs to take to account. But basically and anonymously, the movements fail if they lose unity. The movements fail with a lack of planning, and movements fail if they lose nonviolent discipline. And that are the main reasons why movements fail across the world. Also, some movements die in a startup phase because they are not capable of gaining numbers, or they can't define their vision of tomorrow, or they stick to only one tactics. Occupy Wall Street was a great example. The great movement, a very positive cause, but really limited to only one tactic, really reluctant to accept everything except anti-capitalist rhetorics, and really tied into one pretty demanding tactic of occupation. Then movements can die in what we call engagement phase, when the numbers are bigger, because of the strategic mistakes. Tiananmen was really big, but the students in Tiananmen Square didn't figure it out that they need to negotiate their solution with the Chinese government in 1989, but going for all of nothing bring government in a position that it ordered tanks to appear. So you can make a strategic decision. You can miss the strategic opportunity to proclaim the victory. You can miss the strategic opportunity for the small victory and get out of here. And then at the end of the day, a lot of movements die in what we call the victory phase. Actually, surviving and sustaining victory is really complicated. So it's not only bringing Mubarak down, it is how you build democratic Egypt. So sometimes movements fail in calling a game over too early in the process. Sometimes they pull back and they don't really make the change becoming a new normal or the new constitution or the new legal act. They're kind of very happy of shaking things down and then leave it to the most organized group in the society. Most organized group in Egyptian society in case of revolution was military. And military was not the best vehicle in order to promote and bring on the democratic transition, as we all know, which is why Egypt is now worse off than in 2011. So a lot of movement also die in this victory phase. Sometimes they put too much love in new elites only because they are new. Sometimes they don't understand that you need a constant pressure and vigilance of the people so the change becomes permanent. And these are the main reasons why movement fail. Speaking in general, movements can fail when they're small, movements can fail when they're larger. Most of movements fail because they don't see understanding to continue working after the victory into making this a change permanent. But basically, most of movements fail because of failure in principles. They either are not able to achieve unity or fail unity, they are making the strategic or tactical mistakes in planning, or they lose nonviolent discipline at some point.
I'm curious about your views around we appear to be in the midst of a rise in the sort of prominence of authoritarians, populism, you know, whether we're talking about elections in Europe, we're talking about Brexit here in the UK, but we can talk about Trump, we can talk about Duterte in the Philippines, Erdogan. And I'm wondering what you make of all of this. What's led to this, and where do people go? Where does democracy go in the midst of all of this?
Well, I mean, when you take a look at the last decade in particular, unfortunately, this is the decade of democracy decay. And when you take a look, whether you're looking at the Economist analysis or Freedom House analysis, you can see that authoritarianism is on the growth and freedoms of the people are on the defense in many of these countries. This is particularly worrying trend when it is happening in countries that were partly democratic, like Turkey, or wholly democratic, like some other countries you have mentioned. And we are witnessing the phenomenon, which is that the bad guys are learning, how to meddle with the elections and use the very democratic tools to root up democracy as such. And whether you can talk about the propaganda effort mostly coming from Russia to show that democracy is a stupid thing and it's no better than the autocracy, which is meaning hitting the very foundations, or you are looking at a slowly squeezing thing called a liberal democracy, which is present now in Hungary or in Poland, where the populists gain power through democracy and then immediately start killing the foundations of democracy by stuffing judges with their party comrades and turning the national TV or the public service like BBC into their party megaphones, we are witnessing the same process. What is different now is that the groups need to find a way to defend democratic pillars. And I think defending the democratic pillars, things like free media, judiciary, Congress, Senate in US, elections in UK, is the best way to proceed. So you understand that, first of all, people need to wake up. And this is what many people in the West are figuring out slowly but steadily, that the fact that you had democracy for so many years doesn't mean that you can take it for granted. Because if your democratic institutions are not defended by the people, then the politicians will come and screw it up. This is the nature of the political system. Democracy is not only institutions. If people abandon keeping their electables accountable, then, you know, they can overturn any kind of institution into a tool for autocracy. And that can have been happening in the past in many cases. You can look at the countries where this process is really dramatic, places like Russia, which had far more democratic 10 years ago, Turkey, which was used to be the best case of Islam and democracy, or Philippines. Which were the democracy for decades. And you can see how the bad guys are coming there and actually using elections to get to power and then are killing one by one the democratic pillars or institutions. So the difference is that in an established autocracy, you're challenging the government and challenging the pillars. In a shrinking democracy, you need to defend your pillars. And that also means changing the narrative. We need a new narrative to explain to the people, specifically in Western Europe, that the fact that they had democracy for too long and ignored autocracies on too many different places have only mean that the autocracy is now on can be on their doorstep. And we need to wake up and defend democratic pillars.
How worried are you about what seems to be a rising trend amongst younger people, you know, millennials, who in the West, we've got surveys that are showing that they're losing their interest in democracy, which seems like, you know, the complete reverse of the situation that you had growing up and being a student in Serbia.
It's an interesting thing. I think, I mean, my opinion is that we are criticizing these millennials too much because only because we are getting to become old farts. And it is more or less the same reason why our parents were thinking that listening to punk rock and new wave music will destroy my brain cells. But it didn't. So I think that we need to figure out that, I mean, on one hand, it's a question of how the millennials understand democracy. On second hand, they are very challenging to any kind of power. And that can tell you anybody who ever employed a millennial. And I have my office full of interns, mainly Western organized students. And the way they behave, the way they go straight for the topic, the way that find a way to abandon structures, it's really impressive. I mean, for somebody my age, I'm 45, it's really impressive. So on one hand, they may be less interest in democracy as it is, if the surveys show that. And on another hand, they have more guts to challenge power itself, which is actually a very good prerequisite for people power movement. So I think we need to find a way to basically rebuild the narrative of democracy and values of democracy in the Western world. And I don't think it's a particularly generational issue. I think it's more of a societal task, which should be, of course, embedded in the education.
So you sound very optimistic then. What are some of the ways that you're witnessing millennials challenge power structures in a positive way?
Well, I mean, I'm teaching in this moment in the United States, where actually the bunch of high school students from a school where a massive shooting happened in Florida is shaking the narrative around gun control far more effectively than all the politicians, NGOs, and liberal groups the last 15 years. The reason for this is A, they are vigilant. B, they are mobilizing in schools. C, they are mobilizing across the political spectrum, understanding that their parents are first parents and then Republicans or then Democrats, which is really interesting. And most important, by tackling the right pillars of the support. What is really happening is that around the gun control issue in U.S., you have an omnipowerful organization called National Rifle Association. So instead of going and yelling on the street, these millennials are understanding that they need to target National Rifle Association. So what they do, they are encouraging firms and companies to dispatch and disconnect from National Rifle Association. Up to now, Delta did it. United did it. Hertz and Enterprise Rent-A-Car did it. So they are looking at how to financial, how to financially weaken the pillar, which is in the theory absolutely the best way to deal with the with the companies and business society. So even without any kind of training, these guys are very successful. Recently, their pressure resulted in very places that are vendoring machine guns, places like Exporting Goods or Walmart, to really impose the ban of the legal age from 18 to 21, ban certain type of weapons, or basically impose more control on how this weapons is sold. That means that in 3 weeks, this movement achieved on the ground less accessibility to assault weapons than the politicians from the liberal side have achieved throughout the 20 years. So yes, I see millennials doing stuff, and yes, I see doing a big stuff, and yes, yes, I see them mobilizing very effectively. And I mean, there are probably many other things around the world, but because I'm now for a 3 weeks in US, and I'm looking this on the TV live every day, it's amazing. And these kids are under 18.
It's very powerful. It's very, it is very inspiring as well. And it's also, you it touches on one of the things that you did mention is, you know, safe schools is something that affects real lives, right?
And not only that, and this is exactly where you can build. So safe school is the idea that, you know, doesn't tackle your party identity in any means. You want your kid to go to the safe school, regardless of your party affiliation. It also, it doesn't really tackle the gun control issue. The way they are structuring it now, they're actually selling this idea of the safe schools to the people who are gun owners. And they're telling that, you know, making, being a, this is not a war between those who own guns and those who don't own guns. Because even those who own guns, they lock the damn guns if they have kids home.
Sure.
And, you know, this is the typically the communication message that unites the different groups or mobilizes people from the middle. And this is strategically addressing the very pillars or the institutions that can really be the game changer. Because if these kids persuade Amazon and FedEx not to deliver these type of weapons, then the weapons will be far less accessible to the crazy people who will buy them and kill kids in schools. So that will be a real change. The fact that this change didn't happen through Congress and Senate or whatever state institution only shows that the politicians are failure and these kids are great.
Yeah, that's that is a very powerful case, and certainly does challenge that notion that maybe it's not losing, maybe it's not believing in democracy, but certainly losing interest in the way democracy currently is, which creates the seeds for positive change.
I agree with you, and it's a question. I mean, there is no doubt that there is a large vacuum between the people's needs and the actual political elites. And this is same in my country, in your country, and everywhere else in the world. It depends on who seizes this vacuum. Otpor was a movement in Serbia that seized vacuum, abandoned by the incapable political opposition, the vacuum of uncontents and the fact that, you know, majority of the people were not really happy with Milosevic, but he was so skillful in atomizing the opposition groups that there was not one single group that can mobilize the people. So we recognized this vacuum. We stepped really in with real answers and real courage, and we mobilized tens of thousands of people. That vacuum exists in every country. The question is who takes it off. In some cases, the right-wing populists take it off. In some cases, students from Florida takes it off. So that vacuum is there. This is how the battlefield looks. We are living in a world where people are highly disentangled from their political elites. And political elites have difficulty talking to the common people.
One of the things that is maybe not so much in the West, but in certain countries, in Russia, in Turkey, in the Philippines, individuals who may oppose the government can be put at risk, or their families can be put at risk for speaking out. And we talked about this a little bit, but there can be a lot of negative consequences. For example, there's a prominent blogger in the Philippines who's gone into hiding because of what she's written about the Duterte regime, for instance. And these are the kinds of things that dissuade people from becoming active in opposing politicians and advocating for change. Change does require people to take risks, doesn't it? So how do movements spread that risk out?
The moment you become successful in authoritarian regime, you will be exposed to propaganda, pressure, and oppression. This is why we call this authoritarian regimes. And there are many reasons. There are many ways that these kind of governments can screw your life, but there are also many reasons you can respond to this. And there are two ways to think about it, like two schools of thought. First of all, leaders need to lead. If you are ready to lead, if you are ready to take place, you are ready to be arrested. And for the leaders of the movement, they need to take risk. So one thing is getting to blog and then going into hiding, because that sends a powerful message that repression actually works. It's completely another thing to be super happy getting arrested and making a fun of it, like a famous blogger Navalny is doing with Russia now. The reason why he's so popular and he's growing into the main force of shake in this very apathetic nation of Russia is because he takes risks lightly, and he says, okay, they arrest me, I'll be 15 days in jail, I'll go out, I'll do the same, they arrest me, and so on and so on. So he gives the people the idea, okay, you know, he's there, he's still doing what he's doing, they really didn't kill him. So, you know, if he's ready to take the risk, I will take a little bit of risk. And then spreading the risk on the people in terms that giving people a chance to do small stuff that they can do or they can still get away with it. You know, it's like boycotting the buses in American civil rights movement was not risky. Because if you boycott the bus, what will happen? You take the alternative means of transportation, you still get to work, you don't get fired, and you are not, nobody can make you use the bus. And this is the power of the tactics of non-cooperation. It was the consumer boycott, the straw that broke the camel's back in anti-apartheid movement back there in the 80s. It is the black people understanding that by not buying, they are actually effectively cutting the funds for the military and the police that was oppressing them. So there are many means that people can do low-risk actions, and you can offer these low-risk actions to the people, even in the highest-risk environment. And the clever movements find a way, A, to set the power of the personal example and show that that repression doesn't work on their back, but in the same time, expanding the base of the people who can participate in low-risk action every day. So this is a strategic planning thing. And of course, you predict oppression and you prepare for it, because the oppression work only if it's followed up with a fear. In Serbia in the 90s, we got to the mindset where 2,500 people were arrested, detained, some of them sentenced from small penalties. But you know, that will bring you dates. You could be the best looking sportsman who is not participating in the protest, and you will be considered a societal geek. Or you would be the ugly-looking, bald-headed guy with a thick glasses, but you were holding the megaphone and you were arrested enough time, you will get the best dates. You will be the rock star. So it's also how you frame this thing. You know, you create the people who are arrested. If you treat them as heroes, and if you really, really boost their popularity, then there is a huge price tag in using oppression. And oppression works only when people are afraid.
I think a very interesting lesson around disseminating fear, and the comment about humor early on. You know, there's nothing. I mean, these guys are, they take themselves so seriously, don't they? You know, whether it's Xi Jinping or Trump or whoever, that, you know, the everything is serious, isn't it?
The nature of people in power is that after a long time watching our face on TV and on billboards, you start taking yourself very seriously. Mm-hmm. And you start actually to believe in this image of yourself, not in yourself who you really are, but this image that is portrayed by your friendly media. And then some of these people just can't take the joke, which is why mocking and laftivism is such a powerful tool. So the real laftivism differs from the political satire. And I had an amazing conversation 2 days ago with a probably world's largest expert on political satire, Sophie McLennan, from Philadelphia University. And we were just discussing this thing that political satire is a kind of steam off for society, and you know, making jokes and making irony really makes you clever, and this is very useful and helpful for societies where the politicians are behaving crazy. But laftivism is something else. Laftivism is creating intentional provocation that puts your opponent between the rock and a hard place. It is a battle with Milosevic face, and then police needs to do something about it. It is the toy protest in Russia. In Russia in 2012, after the stolen elections, the people came to the idea that if they can't protest, their toys can. And they built a little Lego town with people protesting election fraud. And first day, everything is fine. Everybody's taping. But the second day, when the thing becomes viral and people start copy-pasting this tactic, the Kremlin intervened. So the poor chief of police needs to come out and really ban a toy protest. Why? Because, you know, it's like the message it sends is that you have this big man who is always what Putin, who always poses shirtless and restless tigers and you know, saving dolphins from drowning. And he's afraid of toys.
Yeah.
And the beauty of laftivism is that puts the big guy who has such a tremendous obsession with him or herself between the rock and the hard place. Because if your opponent reacts, he will look stupid. He will end up arresting Barrel or banning the toy protest. If he doesn't react, he will look weak. And people will understand that they can get away with it. And they will replicate this over and over until they undermine their authority. So understanding how the political satire and laftivism work is a very, very promising field for a nonviolent movement.
So Alec Baldwin's Trump impression is satire, not laftivism.
Yeah, I mean, American comedians are great in satire and irony, and also when you take a look at the satire, it can it influences many people. It influences, including your opponent's supporters. So some kind of satire, which they're attacking your opponent's identity, can lead to the unlikely results. You actually mobilize your supporters, your opponent's supporters, with a satire. But looking at the ideas and kind of mocking ideas and deeds rather than personalities, it's probably far more effective. Yes, basically the Daily Shows and Night Shows are more of a satire. And, you know, the group called Indivisible in US that is chasing their politicians. And then when they don't appear on the town halls because they know they will be faced with the tough questions, then the group comes out and brings out the cardboard version of their congressmen and senators and talk to the cardboard. This is laftivism.
Yes.
This is laftivism, because then you, it's not only satire, then you need to do something about it.
Right.
You either need to show and speak to the people you disagree with, or you will lose the damn election.
Right.
This is going to happen. And you know, this is where it goes. So, you know, the laftivism is a consciously made action that puts your opponent between the rock and a hard place.
Right.
Not only mocking or imitating. It's a little bit more than that.
You're provoking some type of a response that's a no-win situation, effectively. I get it. That makes a lot of sense. And I suppose one of the things that is required for both laftivism and satire is there needs to be some truth in whatever the mocking is around.
I agree. The element of truth is very important in the social movements, and it's even more important in the era where everything is called fake news. So you need to be clear with what your vision is. You need to be honest with the people you try to lead. You need to be honest with the people you try to recruit. I think that it is now more than ever important in this era where everybody is just trying to bluntly increase the bigger lie. Where it is coming from, I don't know. Several years ago, I read a book of a very interesting author who actually now lives in London, Peter Pomerantsev, about the contemporary Russia, named Nothing's Real and Everything is Possible, turning how this disinformation turned into the state-run operation in Russia. Amazingly, this disease seemed to be spreading across the world, and truth seems to become less important than who is telling the truth.
Mm.
And I think this is the one of the most important foundations of democracy, is to be honest with the people you like to govern and to be honest with the people you like to lead. And this is where we need to go back and stick to the truth. Same works with nonviolent movements.
Yes, and one of the things that seems, in my observation, that seems to be happening with this divisiveness and this you know lack of truth as well, is that the discourse is so angry, it's so negative, it's, you know, there's a lot of name calling, there's a lot of viciousness in, whether you see in social media, you just have to scroll through the comment section of an article, and you don't find debate, you don't find dialogue, and you certainly don't find satire. You find hate and anger and lots of negative things.
I agree. I think that's all part of the world we are living at, and this is one of the downsides of the social media, is that it is so easy to hate somebody you don't know, and it is so easy to disagree and so easy to use the language that you would never use if you are in a room with that person, because you know there is a certain polite level that you will behave. But I think it's one of the elements we need to fight, and it's one of the elements of why democracy is under threat. Because if truth is not on the table anymore and only propaganda matters, those who have the most skillful propagandists and most resources to get involved in propaganda will win. And unfortunately, that's not always the best guys.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Have you heard of this thing called the Pro-Truth Pledge?
No, what it is?
No, it's so I've just interviewed Gleb Sapirsky, who is a professor in the United States at Ohio State University, and started basically it's a pledge to promote and honor the truth in interactions with others, and a number of, he's advocating a number of politicians to take the pledge, and people like Steven Pinker and a number of prominent thinkers are taking it. And I find it's a useful device, because if you're interacting with someone you don't agree with, and they've also taken this pledge, then at least you know that you're playing by some rules. I think potentially it's a powerful mechanism. But I think we need a lot of different things.
Sounds like something I would like to be enrolled tomorrow. I'm just writing this down.
Okay, great. I can send you the information. And
my
latest episode is with Gleb, and I can send that to you as well. But I think it's very useful. I do want to talk about, so I know that we're going to need to wrap it up shortly, but you've mentioned before this whole thing about, and it relates to what we just talked about, clicktivism.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was witnessing all of the, you know, all the changes in the Arab Spring and so on, there was I think it was Malcolm Gladwell who had an article saying, and I might get this wrong, but the article title was "The Revolution Will Not Be Tweeted." effectively arguing that, look, you know, social media is a powerful tool, et cetera, but you need people to get out and do things, physical things, mobilize, get into the, you know, get out onto the streets, et cetera, et cetera. You can't just click, share, like things, and that's not going to cause the, you know, the change that people want to see. So I know you've talked about this before, but I'm wondering what you think of now of so-called clicktivism and how we can move on from it.
Clicktivism or slacktivism is this phenomenon that you think you have saved a polar bear by clicking like on a Facebook page, but you actually didn't turn your computer off to really save the polar bear, or save some energy which will somehow influence the existence of polar bears. Yes, movements use social media, and social media are, to be honest, very effective way of spreading information. They are very effective way of putting a price tag on any kind of state-sponsored violence. And they're also a great tool for learning. I think understanding internet as a learning tool, whether the horizontal learning tool between movements who are doing something that works and other movements who take it from there, with no intermediary, into the fact that, you know, it's like I'm sitting now in Harvard. We are teaching from here the online course that is 45 great people from 19 different countries, it would be impossible to get these people on a real five-week workshop in the real world. So yes, the social media and internet have brought some good things. Among things that were not good is this slacktivism or clicktivism. And of course, there are people who say, okay, if you didn't offer people to click like, then they wouldn't even know about the change. But you need to understand that even the most successful online campaigns have at least one foot in the real world. So every single campaign needs to have something in the real world and then use an internet world of spreading it. Take for a moment campaign which is not political at all, and we all know about it. It's called Ice Bucket Challenge. Why Ice Bucket Challenge was such a powerful tool in spreading the word about a very exotic disease and getting money for curing or examining the cure for a very exotic disease was because it was diving into the real world. Like, I'm doing something in the real world. I'm pouring an ice cold water on me. I'm making the funny video. And then I'm challenging several people I know personally from the real world to do the same thing. And then I'm posting video on the internet where the thing becomes viral and gives maybe you or somebody who don't know me the idea that maybe you can do this together. But go back to the thing. I'm pouring water in the real world. I'm donating money in the real world. And I'm challenging the people that I know in the real world to do the same. And then I die into the internet world. So successful campaigns need to figure out that there are two sides of the coin, and yes, clicks and likes are good, but only for spreading people and examples that you're doing in the real world, because the social change are happening in the real world, not in the online world.
Yeah, that's well worth remembering. You talk about hundreds of tactics that people can use to make some change. We talked about a few of them here, you know, stickers, banging pots and pans. Are there a few that that might be worth mentioning in addition to that?
There are so many tactics. Like, okay. I mean, the media gives you this impression that the nonviolent struggle is all about protesting and marching, and basically the things we call the large tactics of concentration. This is where you concentrate your human resources and time in a short span of time, or in a small geographic location like the square. But nonviolent struggle is so much more than this. And if you really want to study, you can go to read Gene Sharp, who outlined 200 different methods of nonviolent action back there in 70s, and there are probably 250 now. Or you can go to Canvasopedia website, where you can find little videos about how you really get involved in tactics and how you really got involved in planning, because it's 21st century, and we know people don't have time to read books, but they will take a look at the 3-minute animated video. Talking about the tactics, it is actually talking about what works. And it is very rare that people are really going through this process, but if they go through this process, they are more likely to be successful. Tactics aim to do one of the three things. Mobilize your supporters. So sometimes you're making a rock concert only to make the people who support your movement happy. Sometimes they need to bring people in the middle. Street theaters, online petitions, recruitment campaigns are there to allow people chance to join your movement. Sometimes, like strikes and boycotts and occupations, they're there to disrupt your opponent. You need to pick tactics carefully, and very rarely people think about why of the tactics or the risk of the tactics, because some tactics can disalienate the very people you like to mobilize. And this is where the story of tactics come in. And this is why in our workshop and university courses, it's like 1/5 of the time is actually planning your tactics. How do you prepare? How do you pick the target? What is the alternative? How do you calculate investment of the resources? What is the turnout of the resources invested in a tactic? And I think the tactics are actually the field where movements have to expand a lot, because this is somebody everybody likes to do, and the less movement is diverse in tactics and the less movement repeats itself in tactics, it becomes less predictable for the opponent and becomes more catchy for potential supporters. So I'm a firm believer in researching tactics. It's actually one of my biggest passions in this field.
Can you talk a little bit about Canvas and its work? You mentioned the videos that you've got on there. For my listeners, can you explain a little bit more about what the group is and what its vision is and what it does?
Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategy, or CANVA, started in 2004 by helping groups from Ukraine and Georgia and Zimbabwe and Belarus, turned into my life mission. Basically, it's a small educational institution based out of Belgrade, run by five people and 12 trainers, whose main goal is to teach people how to build movements. CANVAS works on several different levels. We are best known for the organizing workshops for groups from the ground, and we did it with 50 groups from some of the most oppressive countries in the world. Some of these groups were very successful, guys like Ukraine, Georgia, or Maldives. Some of these people were successful to a certain extent, like the people from Egypt we worked with. Some of these people are still terribly unsuccessful, because it's a project of trying and making mistakes. We provide people with skills. You can't really, as the foreigner, tell people what to do, and you avoid giving advice, but you provide people with skills. Second part of the job, we teach universities, among them in UK, University of Essex, here in US, Harvard and NYU. And last and most catchy thing, we develop tools. Because we think building movements is a skill, we develop tools for building the skill. If you visit our website, www.canvasopedia.org, not only you will find the books and cool manuals, you'll find also a 3-minute animated video, which are covering the concepts like unity or vision that we were talking in the show. Last but not least importance, we are working on an application that will help document human rights abuse and corruption, which is called Whistler and which is now in a testing phase.
Cool. That sounds really cool. Do you do these workshops on the ground? You go into these countries and do the workshops, or a combination of on the ground and virtual, or...
Depending on what we do, the structure of the workshop is normally 5 days. Sometimes you can do it on the ground. Sometimes you need to pull people from certain country and do it out of the country, because due to the years of working, we definitely, as the organization, have a reputation with the different countries where we would really endanger people, really only to meet them, to go in the country. So, you know, you can't really do this thing inside these places. You need to drag people out of these places. And then part of this, it's also online platforms and giving people online tools. So part of this is face-to-face. Sometimes happens in the country, sometimes happens in a neighboring country. And part of this is also online. So we try to combine these two things. We are kind of very, very contemporary in sharing skills. And what really differs a CANVAS type of workshops than anything else, that it's driven by the projects. And the people who participate are people who are really involved in social change on the ground. And then we help them figure out how to make this project or their movement more effective, as opposed to just telling them academically what's there.
Right. And one of the things that you've mentioned before is that, you know, these movements have got to be indigenous, right? The change has got to happen from these places. You can give them tools and tactics, but the movement has to originate and carry out its change wherever, you know, that change needs to happen.
Absolutely. The social change needs to be indigenous. The vision and the ideas needs to be indigenous. The creativity is something that you can't import or export. And the numbers on which the very movements rely are something that can't be exported. I can't really make 1 million Serbs come to London and demonstrate against Brexit or for Brexit or for whatsoever. So this is where it comes to what you can get them. And you can get them skills and knowledge. You can teach these people how to avoid your mistakes, because it's always easier and cheaper to learn on other people's mistakes. And this is what the CANVAS is very specialized in. We think that investing in skills and knowledge of the activists is far the best investment for every movement in the world, because as Ben Franklin once said, there are three types of people in each society. There are those unmovable, there are those movable, and there are those who move. And if you want to change the society, you will help the people who move. And this is all about our mission.
That's really cool. Last but not least, and I know that we're running out of time, but maybe this opens up maybe you have to come back and tell us this, but what is the biggest risk that you've taken yourself, do you think? Or have you thought about that?
Back then in the 90s, everybody was taking risk. I mean, most of us was really put through some kind of police procedure. So I was arrested and badly beaten in 1999. The gun was put in my mouth. And this is really where you kind of go through it and understand that this thing hurts only while you're afraid. If you're not afraid, it's not really effective on you. I used to be a high risk taker because obviously I was one of the leaders of the movement in a very oppressive government. We were on a hit list by the regime, especially at the end. Some of us were arrested, some others were badly beaten, and we heard that there was even an assassination list, which never happened because the change happened. But we were operating under the regime, which was genuinely killing people, whether the opposition leaders or the editor of the main Serbian opposition newspaper was killed in a blunt day by a secret police force, and it was proven on the court. So we had a regime which had political assassinations. Later in my work, we were witnessing a lot of pressures, and of course, when you're aiming for a big change, you have a big opponents. And like every week or two, we get attacked from propaganda outlets of the autocracies, because of course they want to make to deter people from their countries from learning from us, from the fact that you can't really reach China canvas. Behind the great firewall of China, to the fact that you can't really get to my name from inside the Vietnam, to every week or two planting the little articles in Serbian press by pro-Russian media outlets. And, you know, it's like you live with this. Sometimes you get exposed to certain threats. There are a lot of crazy people around the world. And, I mean, but you learn to live with it because, you know, if you believe it, when what you're doing, you will take some risk. More important is how you diminish risks for the others, and how you teach people that spreading the risk across the movement and offering people low risk things to do is really effective in creating numbers. And this is the way we live.
So, Jay, this was great. I thank you very much for taking the time to speak to me, and I'm sure my listeners will enjoy this. So I wanted to be respectful of your time, but to also thank you very much for coming on to the show and speaking to me.
Thank you, Ben. Pleasure talking to you. Big hug to your listeners. If you're interested, go to www.canvasopedia.org. Oh, by the way, you can buy the book. It's a well investment, and I promise it's an easy read. It's called Blueprint for Revolution and published in UK by a great publisher called Scribe.
Brilliant. And we'll put that all in the show notes so everyone can find everything and it will be perfectly accessible. But thank you so much, Sergio. Really appreciate this.
Thank you. Bye-bye, Ben.
I hope you all enjoyed that. Check out the show notes, as I say, in each and every episode. And if there's something you're not quite happy with where you live, maybe don't just wait for some of your leaders to do something. Check out Canvas's site and perhaps start a small movement of your own. You never know where it might end up. Let me know what you think of this episode and of the show. allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to do that. Check out allthingsrisk.co.uk. We will be back next week, but at the end of the week, around April the 13th or so, with our next episode. So subscribe and you won't miss it. More great stuff is on the way in the interim. And as always, don't forget, risk is life.